Introduction. Welcome to a verse-by-verse study of the most precious good news in Paul's letter to the Ephesians. What does it say to us today? Can it still do for us what it did for those people of the first century? What was the secret of its power to change people's hearts? Why was Paul so moved to write it? In particular, we want to see how this little book of only 6 chapters in the Bible casts special light on the most precious message of salvation by faith. Its message must yet illuminate the earth with the glory of the truth of the gospel. If there are questions any of us may have about that message, a study of Ephesians will clear up our perplexities. The ideas that permeate the book are refreshing good news to people of all churches and religions. In fact, they are explosive in their impact, even today. Ephesians, rightly understood, is brimful of New Testament good news ideas. It presents the gospel in a clear light, in harmony with the work of Jesus as our high priest in his closing work of atonement. We live in these last days of earth's history, when the world's great high priest is doing something never done in previous ages, preparing a people to be ready for his second coming. Our study will follow him into his most holy apartment of the heavenly sanctuary, where he is accomplishing this very special work. There are 2 other great letters that the Apostle Paul wrote that appear on the surface to outshine this letter to the Ephesians, Romans, and Galatians. Some say they're the ones that proclaim the gospel with the deepest theology. But Ephesians may top them both in its effectiveness, in lighting the world of Paul's day with these sunlit truths. Some scholars believe that Ephesians was not originally addressed to any one church, but was a general letter for all churches everywhere, for the world at large. The reader can see for himself why this might be plausible. The letter is unusual in that it doesn't have Paul's personal notes of greetings to this or that individual, as we find in most of his other letters, which we now call epistles. One could conclude that this letter was intended for all the churches, yes, that it could be an evangelism document for non-Christian Gentiles as well as for believers. Paul wrote it while he was in prison in Rome, apparently with leisure to compose an edited evangelism message to be sent all over the world. And for sure, if some pagan who had never heard of Christ or his gospel should have chanced across a copy of this letter, now addressed to the Ephesians, his heart would have been warmed. And unless that soul had resisted the seeking grace of Christ, he would have been won to the faith. So it is quite likely that Ephesians did play a large part in the phenomenal spread of the Christian faith in that early century. And now today, this letter is more up to date than tomorrow's media news, because it pulsates with the life of Christ's urgent message he wants to go to the world. Here is that glorious gospel, which is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. It has been described as the Alps of the New Testament. The water of life, flowing out of Paul's heart, comes from a hidden spring, deep in his soul. His work is incomparably greater than that of any mere theologian or philosopher. He loves people as Christ loves them. He specializes first in declaring the objective gospel, what Christ accomplished for the world, even before we were born. Then he zeroes in on the subjective gospel, how this objective truth of what Christ did for us motivates us subjectively to devote our lives to him. The demarcation line between objective and subjective gospel within the letter is so sharp and clear, you can't help seeing it in chapter 4, verse 1. John M. Fowler has gathered testimonials from thoughtful readers of Ephesians. The great reformer John Calvin said it was his favorite letter. William Barclay called it the Queen of Epistles. Charles Dodd, The Crown of Polynesim, E.J. Goodspeed, A Great Rhapsody of the Christian Salvation. May it become to us a beloved source of saving truth in preparation for the second coming of Christ. Paul inspired and trained other fellow laborers in Ephesus. None were jealous of him, and he never shows the slightest envy of their success. For once, in the story of his labors in Ephesus, we see a clear demonstration of what the special love of Christ, known as agape, did for a group of workers. There was Apollos, himself, mighty in the scriptures, and an eloquent man, but Paul worked with him smoothly and in love. There were Priscilla and Aquila, who were also imbued with the same spirit that motivated Paul. Apollos was from Alexandria, the second most important city in the Roman Empire. Highly educated, a Jew converted to the baptism of John the Baptist, he was an eloquent preacher. But he knew nothing of the baptism of the Holy Spirit, and he needed to be instructed in the way of Jesus. Then dear Aquila and Priscilla, in a kind and courteous way, told him what he needed to know, and thank God, Apollos listened. Sometimes, we ministers may not be deficient in the same way that Apollos was, but there are also empty places in our knowledge. The Lord then sends someone to correct us, and instruct us, and fill in the gaps. But we are painfully aware that sometimes our dear ministering brethren, in a past era, were not like Apollos. They may have been mighty in the scriptures, and could argue, and like him, had gaps in their understanding, that the Lord in his great mercy, sent his messengers to fill in, but they were not like Apollos. They were not ready to listen and learn. In a great degree, history has told us, they resisted and even rejected the light that God would have them accept. Now we have come collectively to the very end of time, and where we have corporately failed in past times, we must now overcome. Time is getting short. Now may Ephesians get through to us. There is a very important detail that can easily be overlooked. After Paul had labored in Ephesus, and raised up that church, and strengthened it, he left it in the care of the unprofessional elders. Were they men, engrossed in the amusements and folly of that city, who were halfway in love with Paul's message? Did they sneak attendance at the theaters and stadiums to watch on the sly the alluring gladiatorial combats and the sports? You can be sure, no. These elders were consecrated men, who had overcome their love of the world, and were diligent in their study of Bible truth for their day. Elders in our churches today have a distinct responsibility. They will earn a glorious reward by their fidelity. Paul told these elders in his day, to watch, take heed to yourselves and to all the flock, among whom the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. Those words were spoken not only to ordained pastors, but to elders. They are very important people. They purchased to themselves a good degree in God's estimation. Ephesians needs only to be translated into modern language, so that the apostle is allowed to open his mind and heart to today's world, telling the content of his faith, then Ephesians again will come to life. When Paul pleads with the Corinthians, "We implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God," we know that was also the burden of his heart in writing Ephesians. Now he is appealing beyond Corinth and Ephesus to all the people out there in his world. Simply substitute modern amenities, clothing, and language, and Ephesus is transformed into a modern New York, Tokyo, or San Francisco. People are identical. There are the poor serfs or slaves, who today are technically free, but they are still caught in dreary boredom. There are the wealthy, as always, obsessed in making more money, and there are the masses, in love with violence and sports. The ancient and modern worlds are virtually identical. Ephesus had its huge amphitheater and arena, as modern cities have today. Archaeologists have unearthed the ancient theater, which seated about 25,000 people, bent on the same pleasures many gravitate to today. The Temple of Diana was the center of idol worship in the city. Four times the size of the Acropolis in Athens, it had columns 66 feet high, as impressive to the ancients as St. Peter's is to us today. Huge crowds attended the feasts of the goddess, whose statue was believed to have descended from heaven. Further, in presenting a challenge to the lonely evangelist of Christ, Ephesus boasted the great banking business of Asia Minor, because the worship of Diana fueled the economic life of the city. Let Paul touch the economy, and will they ever hate him? On the north side of the city, stood the stadium, where the races and gladiatorial combats were held. The people were drawn to watch men kill each other. The more violence, the better. The people loved it. Aren't even our video games often based on a secret fascination for killing people? The Odeum in Ephesus was another theater seating 1,500. Self-indulgence and pleasure were all the people knew to live for. Can you imagine? Prostitution was a religious duty. How could Paul ever get through with the gospel effectively to people such as these? But all the great cities of the Roman Empire were much the same as Ephesus. Pagan people were bored with life, except for sensual pleasures of gourmet food, alcoholic drink, violence, and sex. They would feel right at home if they could be resurrected and set down in our modern cities with our sports, games, and TV amusement. As a public evangelist, Paul was challenged by these pagan people to win their attention and then to win their hearts. He met the challenge with the message we find in his Ephesians.